Thanks, guys. Good to be with you. Let me just kind of start with where we are in America. As we look at where we are as a nation right now, we're one of many nations in the world. We have the United Nations that keeps track of how many nations we do have, and there's a lot of them. Most people can't recognize or identify the nations. We may have to, there it goes. You have to reset it. If you would exit out of there and reset it, it's kind of chosen to be frozen. Not doing it. Time out, guys. I'll be right back. It's talking to us. So, we have the Constitution that helps establish our form of government. But as I mentioned, the United Nations, we have 193 nations in the world today. Now, it's interesting. There have been nations in the world for thousands of years. They've all had some form of government. And Cornell University Law School went through and said, okay, 5,800 years recorded history, thousands of nations. What is the average length of a constitution in the history of the world? And for thousands of years, the average length of a constitution has been 17 years. Last September the 17th, we celebrated Constitution Day, which is the birthday of our Constitution. It became 234 years old. Now, imagine living in other nations where the average is 17 years. We look at Ukraine and say, isn't it terrible what's happening in Ukraine? Yes, it is. But that happens on a regular basis, except in America. Do you know an average nation has a violent revolution every generation and a new constitution every 17 years? We're so used to what we have, we don't realize how unique it is. And so we're willing to throw it away, or let's change from free market to socialism. Marxism is pretty good. And we're just convinced that anything we choose is going to work. And it's not. We have ideas that made us different from other nations. In the same way, if you look at our creativity, and we measure creativity by copyright, patent protection, when you look at what we have with creativity, America is 4% of the world's population. 4% of the world's population should produce 4% of the world's whatever. Not us. America has produced more scientific cures, more inventions, more technology, more space stuff, more everything than the other 96% of the world combined. What we have in America is more than everybody else in the world's inventions put together. We're just used to having this. I'll just give you a quick example. I've got two kids, active duty Army. I do a lot of speaking for military, all branches, and do trainings and go to the military bases. So they asked me to go to Germany. I went to Germany. And in Germany, I think there's 27 or 28 Army bases in Germany. So when I was there, I'm a cowboy from Texas, really simple life. When I got to Germany, they put me up in a 5-star German hotel. And I'll tell you, that was really elegant. I've never experienced that. It was super neat. I mean, these are structures that are thousands of years old, and they got these castles and other stuff. And when I would walk in, I've never had service like that. As soon as I'd walk in, they'd say, Mr. Barton, welcome back. It is so good to have you here. They recognized me, called me by name just when I walked through. I never had that. And that 5-star experience, as great as it was, would have been even better if they would have had internet at that hotel. Yeah. Now, I'll point out, even Motel 6 in America, every Motel 6 has got internet. Right. I mean, we're just so used to what we have, we don't recognize how unusual it is because we haven't been to so many other places. And the same thing with our prosperity. Our 4% of the world's population every year produces between 24 and 25% of the world's gross domestic product. That means individual prosperity. Gross domestic product shows the prosperity of a nation. When you look at what we have in America, we have a census that's required every 10 years. Constitution says every 10 years we do a census. So we did one in 2020. 2021, we reported the results of the American census, and we report that if you live in poverty in America, which we don't want anyone living in poverty, but if you live in poverty in America, your lifestyle is higher than the middle class in Europe. Poverty in America is higher than middle class in Europe? Absolutely. You see, the World Bank sets a global standard for poverty. According to the World Bank, if you live on $2 a day or less, you're in poverty. That's $730 a year. Here in America, we have states like Hawaii, states like Mississippi, other states that say, hey, unless you're making more than $61,000 a year, you shouldn't come off government services because that's the minimum you get for government services. Wait a minute. Everybody else at $730 and we're looking at $61,000 a year? That's our standard? See, this is such a different thing. We just don't understand. This is why everybody in the world is lining up at America's borders to get in. If they can get in here and if they can just live in poverty in America, They have elevated their lifestyle beyond their wildest dreams. And see, that's why we're so unique, and nations have recognized this for a long time. Way back in 1831, a guy came to America named Alexis de Tocqueville. He traveled America for 8 months. 1835, he came out with a book, and he said, America is exceptional. This is where we get the term American exceptionalism. He said the condition of the Americans is quite exceptional and made me believe that no democratic people will ever be placed in a similar position. So this is where we get the term. We are the exception. We're not the rule in the world. What we do in America is very different from the rest of the world. And so the fair question is, you know, everybody in the world had access to the same set of ideas. How did we come up with ideas that made us different from others? Because we don't just normally have unique ideas. They came from somewhere. And this is where it'd say, well, probably the guys who wrote our documents, the guy who birthed the nation. These are the guys that are responsible for what we have. And that would be people like George Washington, and it'd be people like John Hancock, and people like John Adams. And yeah, those are really significant guys. But it's interesting to me that in 1816, John Adams was contacted by a man named Hezekiah Niles. Hezekiah Niles was the youth of that generation. He was a young man, what we would call a millennial today. John Adams, when Hezekiah Niles contacted him in 1816, Hezekiah Niles says, I'm writing a history book on the history of the United States. He says, I wasn't there when all of this happened at the beginning. He said, you were. Now, this is 42 years after the American War for Independence began. 42 years after he signed the Declaration, John Adams is there, and Hezekiah Niles says, I wasn't there for any of the stuff that happened back then, but you were. And as I write this history book, I want to know from you. We are so unique. We're so different. Where did you guys get the ideas that led to all the things that we enjoy today? Great question. And John Adams said, well, if you want to know what shaped our thinking, where we got our ideas, he said, I would point to the Reverend Dr. Samuel Cooper. And there's the Reverend Dr. Jonathan Mayhew. Oh, and don't forget the Reverend George Whitfield. And there's the Reverend Dr. Charles Chauncey. Preachers? Really?
Yeah.
Try finding these guys in our textbooks today. Now, we might know who George Whitfield is, but the chances that we know anything about Cooper or Mayhew or Chauncey, absolutely slim to none. We don't know these. We don't know preachers today. We don't cover this in history, whether they're white preachers or black preachers. Who's Richard Allen or Absalom Jones? Or who's John Morant? Who's Lemuel Haynes? Or, for that matter, who's Harry Hoosier? Harry Hoosier? Oh, the Hoosier State. I wonder how many people who live in Indiana know that they were named after a black evangelist. Probably very few. But that's where the Hoosier State got its name, because so many of the converts of Harry Hoosier moved into Indiana, and their behavior and lifestyle was so different from everybody else. They said, what's up with those guys? They're really strange. Oh, they're a bunch of those Hoosiers. You see, they didn't drink as much. They didn't cuss as much. They didn't fight as much. They were very different. Hoosier State, named after black evangelists. See, this is part of the problem we have today. One of the reasons that we have been studying critical race theory in the last few years in America, we didn't study it 30 years ago. How come? Because we knew more about our own history. But see, today, if I went through a lot of the black history heroes, if I said James Armistead, or if I said Prince Estabrook, or if I said Jack Sisson, or if I said Billy Florida, or Prince Whipple, or I just go through all the other heroes, we don't even know who they are today. And so what happens is John Adams, he's asked, where did these ideas come from? John Adams says, well, from the pulpit. Now, it's interesting. How can we document that? Well, historians have documented that. They've gone back, for example, to the Declaration of Independence, and they've documented that every single right set forth in the Declaration of Independence had been preached from the American pulpit prior to 1763. So if you want an interesting homework assignment, go read the Declaration of Independence as a listing of sermon topics, because that's what it was back there. For 15 years before they wrote the Declaration, they heard all those things covered in the pulpit. This is what shaped the thinking of America. It's what caused us to be quite different. And John Adams talked about how our pulpits have thundered. That was his phrase. And when you look at the sermons they preached back then, he's right. We own 160,000 documents from American documents and artifacts from American history. I own thousands of these original sermons. We've got them up on the website. You can read these old sermons. And what you'll find is they address biblical relevancy in a way that we really don't even think about today. If I can take you back to the Great Commission for a moment. You know the Great Commission, Matthew 28, 18 to 20. The Scripture says very simply, Jesus said to his disciples before he ascended in heaven, he says, all power is given unto me in heaven and earth. Therefore, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. Now notice he said, teaching them to observe all things, everything. Jesus was into making disciples. He took those guys over 3.5 years. He created folks that changed the entire world. And so as a result today, the largest religion in the world is Christianity. 32% of the world professes to be Christian as a work of what Jesus did with 12 guys who took that gospel everywhere, gave us the scriptures that we have, particularly in the New Testament. So What you have is Jesus discipled these guys really well. And you know, at the beginning, they weren't thinking right. They weren't acting right. Just look at Peter, look at what happened with James, and look at what happened with others. So we know that Jesus was able to get them thinking right. Now, it's interesting. As a result of political pressures that came against the church, particularly in the 1950s and 1960s, the church kind of changed the way it viewed the culture. The church looked at the culture, and we got, as a result, into, we'll just do spiritual things. We're not going to do all the outside things we used to do. Did you know in Hollywood before 1966, a movie wouldn't come out of Hollywood unless the church had signed off on it? But in the 60s, the church said, oh, we shouldn't be involved in stuff like that. We're going to, how'd that work out for us? Now that the church has gotten out of that arena, and the church got out of academics, and the church got out of so many arenas, it hadn't worked well for us. And so what we did was we said, we'll do the, quote, spiritual things. And so as a result, we turned the Great Commission into an evangelism mandate. And that is not bad at all. We know evangelism is very important. You look at what Jesus said in John 3:3, that you've got to be born again. Or you look at what Paul said in Acts 16:31, what must I do to be saved? He gives the answer. Or Romans 3:23 and 6:23 and Romans 10:9 and 10, all the passages. We know that's really important. We know that saving souls is good all the way back to Proverbs 10:28. It says, he that winneth souls is wise. But that's not what the Great Commission is all about. That's part of it. But see, salvation is not the destination. That's the beginning point. See, right. We're told at that point, once we do that, is to teach them everything I've commanded you, which would include what Jesus taught about no-fault divorce in Matthew 19. It would include what Jesus taught about criminal justice in John 8. It would include what Jesus... Have you noticed how many of the parables Jesus gave are economic parables in which he covers things like minimum wage in Matthew 20? And the capital, what we call the capital gains tax in Luke 19. I mean, he covered all of that. He said, guys, you got to think right. And so he says, you go make disciples. You teach them everything I've taught you. See, the Great Commission was about discipleship, which starts with salvation, but it's about making disciples. And this is what the church got away from in recent years that it did really well in earlier years. And so if I take you back to some of these sermons where we teach all things, let me go back to 1755. Boston had a great earthquake. Now, Boston's not a place you have earthquakes. California, maybe. Boston, no. And so since this was a big deal in their news, their position was whatever is in the news, we want to show you the Word of God applies to whatever happens in life. And so as a result, the Reverend Dr. Jonathan Mayhew, one of those guys I specifically told you about that John Adams pointed to, Reverend Dr. Jonathan Mayhew preached this sermon. It's a discourse on earthquakes, or a sermon on earthquakes, right out of Revelation 15. It's interesting. You'll find sermons on earthquakes. You'll find sermons on floods, sermons on anything that went wrong, any kind of natural disaster. We're saying, here's what the Bible says about that particular natural disaster. By the way, if you want to shock yourself, try to think of the verses you know in the Bible that deal with earthquakes. And I can name a few. I can say, okay, there's the earthquake under King Uzziah. There's the earthquake with Amos. There's the earthquake when Jesus crucified, when Jesus resurrected, and that's about as far as I can go. I recently looked up online just to see, found dozens and dozens of verses that dealt with earthquakes. I've never even looked at that before because it never crossed my mind the Bible might address something like that. They looked at the Bible as a very practical book. They also had sermons on topics like this, comets, or as you see at the bottom, two sermons occasioned by the late blazing star. The Bible has so much to say about science and astronomy. God calls constellations by name in the book of Job, Orion and Pleiades. You see, we had sermons on solar eclipses and lunar eclipses and discovery of new planets. The planet 1847 got sermons on that. We just covered anything that was in astronomy because God did. In the same way, this is a sermon on the infirmities and comforts of old age. Now, I will say that's probably not a popular sermon, but it's a really needed sermon. Everybody's going to grow old. I don't care what age you are. You're going to grow old, and that things change when you do. And you've got to deal with people who grow old. So we had sermons on aging. We also had sermons on the military, religion and patriotism, the constituents of a good soldier. By the way, that was preached here in Virginia, Paul Church. Samuel Davis preached this in 1755. It was a deployment sermon. And it's interesting that, and you're going to see all these sermons, these are really what we call revival sermons. They happened during the first or the second Great Awakening. 1755 is right in the middle of the Great Awakening in Virginia, and this was a military sermon. And why not? Even when John the Baptist is baptizing people, he has specific instructions for officers and for soldiers. The Bible's full of military guidance. This is a sermon on the relation of the medical profession to the ministry, healthcare in the Bible, absolutely. When God gave his code to his people back in the Old Testament, back in the Torah, he gave 613 laws. Now, 10 of them we know really well, the Ten Commandments. But he gave 613 laws, and that dealt with economics, and that dealt with consanguinity, and that dealt with immigration, and they dealt with criminal justice and due process, and they dealt with health care. There's a really good health care code in the Bible, and God even promises people that if you'll follow my health code, he told them in Exodus 15:26, he said, if you'll follow my health code, I will put on you none of the diseases that I put on the Egyptians. You'll have a really healthy, different life. You won't be like everybody else if you'll follow what I gave in the health codes. That's why we had sermons on health codes. This is a sermon on the character and tendency, the property tax by Reverend Glover. Property tax? Really? Yeah. Again, notice how many of Jesus' parables deal with economics. The Bible addresses estate taxes, inherited taxes. It addresses what we call capitation taxes, flat taxes. It addresses progressive taxes. The Bible addresses so many areas on economics, and we have lots of sermons on economic issues. This is a sermon preached in front of the legislature of Virginia. It's the sinfulness and pernicious nature of gaming. A sermon preached before the General Assembly of Virginia at Williamsburg, March the 1st, 1751. Another Great Awakening sermon. Today, 95% of Christians cannot put a single Bible verse to anything related to gaming or lottery or gambling or anything else. We don't know that topic anymore. This is a sermon preached in Massachusetts in 1852 called A Good Sermon or Good Law. It's a sermon. Legislature of Massachusetts had just passed a law on alcohol, and we said, well, here's what the legislature did. Let's see what God says about that issue. And they looked at it and said, based on what God says about that issue, that's a good law. And so they said that they did the right thing. That's good. So we looked at public policy through that biblical filter. Here's another example. The injustice and policy of the slave trade and the slavery of the Africans illustrated in a sermon. This is a Virginia sermon from 1791. It was the church that worked so hard to end slavery. It was the church that said, you know what? That thing in the Declaration says all men are created equal. That comes right out of the Bible. It comes out of Colossians. It comes out of Acts 17:26. Comes out of 1 Samuel 6:9. It has all these passages. It was the church that led the way. So this is a sermon from 1791 in Virginia. This is a sermon from New Hampshire. It's 1837. It says marriage scripturally considered. The legislature had just passed a law dealing with marriage. And so once again, we said, here's the new public policy. Here's what the Bible says. Okay, that's a good law on marriage because it lines up with what the Bible says. This is a really interesting sermon. This is on the fugitive slave law. The fugitive slave law was passed in 1850. The sermon was preached in 1851. And I've got a stack of sermons on the fugitive slave law. Of the millions of laws passed by the federal government, this is hands down one of the three most wicked federal laws ever passed by the government. And this law, when it came out, the next year the pulpits were just alive with this because they said, okay, guys, here's the new law. Look what the Bible says. Here's what the federal law says. They said, if you obey this federal law, you're disobeying the Bible. If you're going to obey God, you have to commit civil disobedience against this law. This law was that wicked. This is what led to jury nullification because a lot of people who would be arrested under that law and they would go to a jury trial, the jury said, there's no way we're convicted them because if we convict them under that law, that's an unjust conviction. We're saying not guilty. And so that's where jury nullification got started. This is also what led to the Underground Railroad. This law is what started the Underground Railroad. So the church is saying you can't follow this law because it disobeys God? Yes. See, whatever came out, we looked at biblically, and that's what shaped America. So social policy was very common. This is a law. This is a sermon on the cry of Sodom inquired into. It's an LGBTQ sermon. It talks about homosexuality. Now, it's interesting. The Bible is very rich with information about sexuality and what is correct and incorrect morally and biblical morals. It's there, but it's something we don't much talk about today. Polling shows us, we do a lot of national polling. Polling shows us right now that 77% of Christians self-censor on this issue because they know that if they talk about this issue, somebody's going to get mad, they're going to offend somebody, and they're going to get themselves in Facebook jail or they're going to get deplatformed or whatever else. And so the church is really, and the culture around us, to our friends and others, we've really gone silent on this issue. The Bible's not silent on this issue, but we've gone silent. The other side is super loud, and so people growing up, they hear one side and not the other, and they think this must be fine. See, we were addressing this back then when this really wasn't addressed. This was a very offensive sermon in their day because the whole issue of sexual morality, doing what's what is indicated by LGBTQ plus was just anathema to the way people thought. I mean, my grandfather, I remember when we were talking, a cowboy in Texas, we were building the fence, and we were talking about things in the culture, and I mentioned homosexuality, and he looked at me and said, "What in the world is homosexuality?" In his generation, that was never mentioned. It was so anathema. Well, it's mentioned all the time in our generation, and so we're not talking about it, but we've lost that biblical view on this issue. There's other sermons I can point to, election sermons on government and elections on public policy type things. So there's a lot there. And when you look at all these sermons in that day, I mean, this is where John Adams said the pulpits have thundered. We did address biblical relevancy. Now, it's interesting to me that people still want the Bible to be relevant today, and it is relevant. We just don't know how to apply it sometimes. Some of the national polling we see, for example, if you look at the direction of Christianity in America over the last several decades, back in the year 2000, 85% of Americans professed to be Christians. In the year 2020, 20 years later, 65% of Americans profess to be Christians. We've seen Christianity in America decline by 20 points in 20 years. That's a point a year. That's not the right trajectory. And so why do people leave church? Well, in polling, asking why don't you go to church anymore, 2 out of 3 say because we don't find it to be relevant to what goes on in our lives. This is theoretical stuff. We need stuff that deals with us right now. And so this is an issue that we used to deal with. And by the way, got to go back to what was mentioned earlier. I mean, as Chad talked about, with what happened in Wisconsin, and they wrote on the walls, "God killed his son, so why can't we kill ours?" Point of correction, God didn't kill his son, we did. Sin is what killed his son. God didn't kill his son. It was sin that did that. And so you get that bad worldview, it's going to lead to bad policies and bad behavior and bad reactions. This is where having a biblical knowledge affects everything that goes on. But because we've had the slip where we're now blowing up stuff because we can't murder our kids, this is where we see a lot of people saying we really need a revival in America. We're praying for revival. Things have to change. And I'm glad we're praying for revival, and we do need a revival. But I think we've got a major problem facing us. I don't think we're going to have the revival we think we're going to have. And the reason is because we're obsessed with really a national focus. Let me see if I can explain this. Everybody gets their news from somewhere, and we get national news. If you're on the right, if you're conservative, you're probably going to listen to Fox News or Victory News or The Blaze or Epic Times or Newsmax. Great. If you're on the left, you're probably going to listen to CNN or you're going to listen to MSNBC or whatever. It doesn't matter. What you get is a steady diet of national news. As a result, you're pretty well informed on what's going on with Congress and what's going on with the Supreme Court and what's going on with the White House. We know that. But you haven't heard a story on Waterton, New York, or Scottsbluff, Nebraska, or Jacksboro, Texas, or Yukon, Oklahoma. See, we know more about what's going on nationally than in any area around us. If I ask you to name the president of the United States, you probably can. If I ask you to name the president of your local school board, it's a lot tougher. If I ask you to name 3 members of the federal Congress, you probably can. If I ask you to name 3 members of the city council, probably can't. We're really well informed what's going on up there, but you know what? We can't change what's going on at the national level. Even if I've got really good connections at the national level. I've been involved in 13 cases of the U.S. Supreme Court, involved in one this year. I've got lots of connections. As a matter of fact, let me just take what happened last August. Last August, as we said, we're going to be out of Afghanistan by the end of August. Well, terrorist groups said, America's leaving, we're moving in. So 20 terrorist groups moved in. I help run an organization called the Nazarene Fund. We save persecuted Christians around the world. We've saved hundreds of thousands. We have chief top tier 1 operators on the ground. And so the military actually called the Nazarene Fund, JSOC called the Special Forces guys and said, "Hey, we're busy trying to save the airport and keep the Taliban and the terrorists back. Would you guys take control of evacuating all the civilians out of here?" And we said, "Sure, we'll do that." And so we got thousands out in that period of time. We got thousands of Christians out. We got a lot of the SIV P1, P2 holders. Those are the allies who fought with the American soldiers in Afghanistan over the last 20 years. We got 1,200 Americans out. We got lots of people out. And we're having to do all this with 20 different terrorist groups pushing on us from every direction. And you know what? Our biggest problem wasn't the 20 terrorist groups. The biggest problem we had was the State Department. The State Department, we had planes where we rescued people and had them in the air. We had a plane going to Albania. We had 2 planes going to Albania. The State Department called ahead to Albania and said, "Don't take those planes. Send them back to Afghanistan." wait a minute, you guys asked us to get the guys out of here, and now that we're saving them, you're sending them back? We had a plane going to Macedonia. The State Department called ahead to send that plane back. So we sent them back, and now the Taliban knows these are Christians on the plane, and guess who gets killed? This is not a good deal. So I started calling U.S. senators that I knew and U.S. congressmen, dozens of them, and they put pressure on Secretary of State Blinken, and he put pressure on the State Department, and couldn't get the State Department to change its position, even with Blinken pushing on. See, it really frustrates me. I really ticked me off. But see, I've got connections. Most people don't have connections. And even my connections meant nothing. I couldn't get anything done at the federal level. And that's where most of us are. And that's why we get angry over what we see going on. We feel paralyzed like we can't do anything. And the problem is we shouldn't be looking at what's going on nationally. We should be looking at what's going on around us. And let me give you an example of that. Let me take you to the American War for Independence. Because right here, Virginia, I mean, this is the heart of all the stuff that went on with the birth of America. If you look at the first four battles in the American War for Independence, interesting what happened in those first four battles. George Washington is the national commander-in-chief. But you know what? Nobody in any of those four battles contacted George and said, George, you're the national guy. We need a lot of help. We're overpowered by the British. We're outnumbered 10 to 1. Send us help quick. Nobody contacted George and said, we need help. He's national commander-in-chief, yeah? But their attitude was, it's our community. We'll take care of it. George, you got really important stuff to do. You're going to have lots to do at Brandywine and Monmouth and Yorktown. And so we got this. And that's the way most of the American Revolution went, was we acted locally. More than 80 major battles in the American War for Independence, George was involved in very few of them. Now, we definitely needed George when we needed George, but even at those battles, local people showed up in huge numbers to support what was happening. So let me take you to these first four battles real quickly. The first one is the Battle of Lexington. It happened on the 19th of April, 1775. In that particular battle, it's interesting, 700 British came to town. Now, we're told in our textbooks that 70 courageous Americans went out to withstand the 700 British. Not quite accurate. What happened was Reverend Jonas Clark took his church out to defend the town, and there were 70 people, 70 men in the church. So when they went out there, the deacon of the church who had been training the men is John Parker. This is the Minuteman statue that you'll see at Lexington. John Parker, deacon of the church. And way back earlier, Jonas Clark, pastor of the church, said, you know, he said, we've had the Boston Massacre. The British have been shooting at us and killing us for 5 years, and we haven't separated yet, but it could come to a point where we're going to have a war. And if we do have a war, what does the Bible tell us about war? And so I started looking into the war and Bible, and he said, all right, the Bible makes it really clear you can't have an offensive war. You can't start anything. But if the British start something, you can defend yourself, but you can't start anything. God will bless a defensive war. Self-defense is allowed. Exodus 22 and twice in Nehemiah and once in Luke and all these other passages. So he was really clear. Guys, you can't start anything, but if they start it, you can engage to defend yourself. And so when John Parker had them out there, he gave a famous statement. It's engraved in stone at the bottom of his statue, and he simply reminded them of what Pastor Clark has been teaching us. He said, guys, he says, stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon. Defensive war. He said, but if they mean to have a war, let it begin here. We're drawing a line right here. We're not going to start anything, but if they do, we're not going to back down. And so what happened, we lost that morning, and it wouldn't have mattered if we'd had SEAL Team 6 on our side. We still would have lost because, you see, everybody had a single-shot musket. It took 15 to 20 seconds to reload just one shot. So when you have 700 guys shooting at 70 guys and everybody's got a single-shot musket and they get the first shot, no, we're not going to win that battle. And we didn't. 18 Americans hit the ground that morning. By the way, both black and white patriots hit the ground that morning. White patriots like John Dobbins, black patriots like Prince Estabrook, all went to church together. Never heard that. And Prince Estabrook recovers and goes on to fight a number of other battles as well. So what happens after this conflict at Lexington, the British go on to Concord. That's their next stop. That's where they're actually headed. And the guys at Lexington try to say, no, you're not going to do that. So when they get to Lexington, we read in the history books that between 300 and 400 courageous Americans went out to face the British. And again, not accurate. Reverend William Emerson brought his church out to face the British, and he had between 300 and 400 men in his church. So when they got there to Northbridge at Concord, Reverend Emerson said, you're not going to do this in Concord. You're just not going to do it. And by the way, we heard you fired at our brethren back over at Lexington. Game on. And that's where we get the first shots at the British, because they've now shot at us. And that's where the first British hit the ground that morning. Now, the commander of the British says, this is not a good direction, because I faced 70. Now I'm facing between 300 and 400. I've only got 700 guys. If I don't get reinforcements real quick, I'm going to be outnumbered in a hurry. And that's the third battle, which is the road to Boston. It's a 19-mile running battle where he's trying to get back to Boston, get reinforcements. And what he feared did indeed happen. Job 3:25 says, that which I feared has come upon me. And yes, it did. He had 4,500 Americans lining the roads on both sides, shooting at him as he was going by. Now, where'd they come from? Reverend Benjamin Balch brought his church out. Reverend Payson Phillips brought his church out. Again, is we're not going to start anything, but you're just not going to do this in our town. And they had this local mentality of, this is our town, and we're not going to let this happen in our town. Now, I'm not saying go pick up guns and shoot. That's not it at all. Just notice the backbone that they had and the willingness to defend their own areas from whatever was happening, whatever was going in local government or anything. It didn't matter. So the fourth battle was the Battle of Bunker Hill. And at Bunker Hill, you had Reverend Joseph Willard, who said, I got two companies in church. Let's go across town and get with the other churches and defend Boston. That's what the Battle of Bunker Hill was. So when you look at those first four battles in the American War for Independence, you get a pretty good idea of how this went, because it was local battles. Virginia was full of local battles. I mean, what happened at Great Bridge down by Chesapeake, all those battles, significant battles, but it was local people who went out and fought those battles, and that's where we win so much of what went on. So the national victory is won when you win enough local battles, and that's that local focus. But again, I mentioned we're praying for revival, and that's a good thing to pray for, but the same thing happens with revivals. You don't have national revivals, you have local revivals. Now, wait a minute. I remember the Great Awakening. That's a national revival. Yeah, we look at it that way, but let me back you up for a minute. The guy who was really key in that revival, and there's a lot of significant names, but the chief name is going to be George Whitefield. Now, George Whitefield preached 34 years in America. He preached 18,000 sermons in America during the what we call the Great Awakening. He preached 14,000 sermons in Europe during the Great Awakening. That's 32,000 sermons preached in 34 years. That's nearly 1,000 sermons a year. That means he was preaching about 3 sermons a day. Now, in addition to that, it's estimated that 80% of all Americans physically heard him preach a sermon. 80%? Oh my gosh, that's message penetration. Twitter doesn't get that. Facebook doesn't get that. Nobody in America gets that. I mean, that's with all of our high-tech stuff, big tech. 80%? How did that happen? He was the chaplain in the colony of Georgia. He got on his horse in Georgia, and he had a portable pulpit. He put it on the horse with him. He took that portable pulpit, and he rode all the way up to Maine. Now, Maine at that point was part of Massachusetts. Maine didn't become a state until 50 years after this. So he gets in on his horse in Georgia and rides all the way to Maine, as far north as he can go, and he preached in every town he went through. He just stopped, pulled that pulpit out, set it up, and just preached everywhere he went. Then when he got to Maine, he turned around and went back to Georgia on horseback, but he took a different route, and he preached at every town he went through on the way back. And then when he got to Georgia, he turned around and went back to Maine. He did that 7 times on horseback, back and forth. So it took him 34 years. He got it done. It's interesting. The reason that 80% of all Americans physically heard him preach a sermon is because he preached in 80% of the towns in America. I mean, he was going. And see, we call it a Great Awakening because so many local revivals broke out that it looked like a national revival. But see, what happened when it broke out, like when it broke out over west of here in the valleys, when it broke out over there, Samuel Davies was the guy there, and he kept it going for a decade and a half after it broke out. And Samuel Cooper was the guy that kept it going in Boston for a couple of decades after it broke out in Boston. Gilbert Tennant was the preacher who kept it going in Philadelphia after it started. See, they were local revivals, and they stayed local revivals, but there were so many local revivals, it looked like a national revival. But again, the focus was on local things and local revivals. So when you look at what happens with those local revivals, our obsession with the national focus really does need to change to a local focus. And all the inundation we do of national news stories doesn't help us think right about what we need to do. So let me take you how this applies to something like civil government and something as simple as voting. To vote in America, the Constitution has 2 requirements. To be a voter in America, you have to be 18 years old and you have to be a legal citizen. 100% of people who are 18 years old, who are legal citizens, can vote in elections. We do have, however, one more thing we require. We require a piece of paper be filled out, voter registration, because we want to make sure you don't vote seven times or somebody doesn't vote for you seven times. We want ballot integrity. We want honesty and truth. So just fill out a paper. Register to vote. At this point in time, among adults, and I'm only talking about adults, among eligible voters, 65.3% of eligible voters have registered to vote in America. That means we've got 100 million adults, including millions, tens of millions of Christians who, I don't care what happens to America, I ain't doing nothing with it. I'm sitting this one out. They can't even be salt and light in the civil arena if they want to because they refuse to register to vote. Now, once you register to vote, once you become a voter that can vote, there's two types of elections. The first type of election is a presidential election. That's where we have the highest voter turnout. In the last 11 presidential elections, we've averaged a voter turnout of 54%. But that's 54% of registered voters, not of American adults. So 54% of 65.3% means that in presidential elections, about 36% of adults vote for president, and it takes half of that to win. Then we have the other type of elections called off-year elections. So this is what we're having this fall. This is where we choose. A lot of states will choose their governors, but you're going to choose congressmen, you may choose U.S. senators, and may choose state legislators, whatever. That's the non-presidential stuff, and we choose that. And for the last 21 off-year elections, the average voter turnout has been 38%. But that's 38% of registered voters. That's 38% of 65.3%, which means 26% of adults vote for governor and for legislators, et cetera. And it takes half of that to win. So what we've seen is in the last 11 presidential elections, one out of five Americans chooses the president of the United States, and one out of eight Americans chooses our governors and our senators and our congressmen, et cetera. And then when you get to the local level, the average voter turnout is about 6%. But that's 6% of 65.3%, which means about 4% of adults vote in local elections, and it only takes half of that to win, which is about 2%. Let me give you examples of how this works. I'm going to take you to Los Angeles for a minute. Los Angeles is the nation's second largest city behind New York City. Los Angeles is so big that the population of Los Angeles is larger than the combined population of 23 individual states. So if you're Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, that's like being a governor in 23 states. Eric Garcetti, mayor of Los Angeles, brags about the fact that he was elected with 2.9% of the vote. Really? And then let me take you to Houston for a minute, because in the city of Houston, that's the nation's fourth largest city. And, Houston, by the way, is larger than the population of 20 individual states. And in the city of Houston, they elected Anise Parker with mayor, and she was elected 4.9% of the registered vote. That was 3.3% of adults actually voted. And when she got elected, she said, you know, you Christians say that marriage between a man and by the way, she was the first open lesbian mayor of Houston. She said, you Christians say marriage between a man and a woman, you're personally attacking me. You hate me. No. Anise, we were saying this before you were ever born. We were saying this since Genesis 1, 2, 3. This is what God said about marriage. It's not us. This is what we believe. No. It's a personal attack on me. So she passed an ordinance that was called HERO. That HERO ordinance stands for Houston Equal Rights Ordinance. The top 200 cities in America have passed what are called Equal Rights Ordinances or Equal Rights Amendments or Human Rights Ordinances or Human Rights Amendments. But this said, if you say marriage between a man and a woman, it's a crime. They passed it in San Antonio. San Antonio, if you say marriage between a man and a woman, it's a Class C misdemeanor, $500 a day fine. If you say marriage between a man and a woman, you're never allowed to run for office in San Antonio, and you can't do any business with the city. You can't be a paving contractor, a landscaper, or anything else. So that's what 200 cities have. And so when she got this into city law, she said, okay, I know of five pastors who have been saying this. And she went after them. They're called the Houston Five. She issued subpoenas. I want 17 different forms of your communication. I want to see your text messages. I want to see your emails. I want to see your phone messages. I want to see all your sermon notes. I want to access your community. And if you said marriage between a man and a woman, you've had it. So this is what she did. Well, the city didn't elect her. The city elected her to fix the roads and keep crime down, whatever. So we got 4,500 churches involved and got this as a referendum on the city ballot. And so got it on the city ballot, and the day before the election, Houston Chronicle ran a poll and said, no, she's going to win this big time. The city is firmly behind her on this issue. It's going to be a 60-40 smackdown, and that's what the polling showed. Yeah, but the next day we had the vote, and the next day 14% of the people turned out, and she got smacked down by 22 points. It was a 61-39% repudiation of what she'd done. Now, Matt point out, 14%, that's pathetic. Yeah, but that's five times higher than what it had been when she was elected. You see, we in America, we're on the verge, the tipping point, and we've got tens of millions that haven't gotten involved yet. If we just up the percentage just a small amount, we get a disproportional result. It goes massively the other direction. And so there's so many examples of this. I'll give you just a few more real quickly. If I take you to Fort Worth, Texas, Fort Worth is the 13th largest city in the nation. And 6.5 years ago, the school board of Fort Worth came up with a new policy, new way to approach things. They said, you know what? We've decided gender is up to the students. They can choose whatever gender they want, which means they choose whatever bathroom they want. They can choose whatever locker room they want, choose whatever shower room they want, totally up to the kids. Well, Arnie Duncan at that time was Secretary of Education for President Obama. He said, why didn't I think of that? That's a brilliant idea. So he came out with a national policy that said if your school, if your public school receives federal funds, which is 97% of the public schools in America, you can't do gender stuff. Gender's gone. We're not going to do that. Now, I will tell you, this was disturbing to me because I am a cowboy from Texas, and I live real close to Fort Worth, and the Fort Worth nickname, Fort Worth is known as Cowtown USA. Twice a day on Main Street, we have cattle drives up and down Main Street, literally. That's what you see right there. Now, I will tell you, you may not be a cowboy, and that's fine. I can take any one of you and put you behind that herd, and you can very quickly tell me which are the bulls, which are the cows, and which are the steers. You don't have to be a cowboy, and it doesn't take a biology degree. And we've never seen a bull become a cow, or never seen a cow become a bull. And Fort Worth, Cowtown USA, comes up with this crazy nonsense. So I looked at what happened in the city. There was 918,000 voters in the city. And I looked at the school board president who came up with this silly policy, and he was elected with less than 1,200 votes. I think it was 1,182 votes is what he was elected with. So I started checking his district and quickly found an evangelical Bible-believing church with 3,000 registered adults. That one church could have prevented him from being on the school board, which would have saved the whole nation from 6.5 years of gender nonsense that we've had. It was back to a local race, a local issue. See, out of this came things like Bentonville, Arkansas. Bentonville is the hometown of Walmart. Bentonville has 40,000 people in Bentonville, and there was a Christian lady there who said, you're not going to do this in our city. So she ran for school board, and she got elected to the school board. In that town of 40,000 people, 35 votes were cast for school board, and she won the majority of the 35 votes. And if I take you to Riceville, Iowa, there was a farmer in Riceville, Iowa, up on the northern border who said, you're sure not doing this in our town. And he ran for a school board there. And it turned out that on election day, he got busy on the farm and didn't get the vote. And don't think he lost by one vote, because that's not what happened. What happened is not a single person voted in the school board election. If he had voted for himself, he would be on the school board simply by voting for himself. See, this is local stuff, and this is where you can have the impact and make the change. And this is where things can be turned around. But we've got all this national news, and we're watching. What can we do with the president? What can we do with the House? What can we do with the Speaker? What can we do with the State Department? No, what you can do is right here. It's significant that Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration, John Adams, by the way, said of the 250 founding fathers, he said, the three most notable founding fathers, number one is George Washington, number two is Ben Franklin, number three is Benjamin Rush. Don't know the guy today, we should. He started the first abolition society in America, started the first training for black ministers, first medical training for black physicians. He started academic education for women. He started five universities. He also started the first Bible society in America, also started the Sunday school movement in America. I mean, the guy's just amazing what he did. He also is called the father of public schools under the Constitution. Because in 1790, he wrote this piece called On the Middle of Education Proper and Public. He said, guys, we used to be 13 separate nations, and we didn't even like each other, but now we're one nation with 13 states. So what do we have to teach in schools if we're going to stay a nation? And he said, well, the purpose of public education is threefold. He said, the number one purpose of public education is to teach students to love and serve God. Now, I will point out, it just about takes a Christian school today to do that. Yeah, that's what the courts did in a period of judicial activism. After 340 years of reading the Bible in schools and having prayer in schools in 1962, 1963, in three cases, Abedin Shemp, Murray Curlett, Ingle Vitale, the Supreme Court said, you know, we've decided that's enough prayer in schools, enough Bible reading in schools. So after 175 years under the Constitution and 340 years in American history, we said no more prayer in schools, no more Bible in schools, and that's where we started Christian schools. What are Christian schools now is what used to be public schools prior to the 60s. Back in the 50s, what's happening at Christian schools, that was public schools. Nonetheless, Benjamin Rush says, the number one purpose of public schools is to teach students to love and serve God. The number two purpose of public schools is to teach students to love and serve their country. The number three purpose of public schools is to teach students to love and serve their family. Please notice the order there. Every Christian I know would say that's out of order. It should be God and then family and then country because family is more important. And Benjamin Rush said, no, you're wrong. It should be God and then it should be country and it should be family. And he explained, he said, if you ever lose control of your country, the country will become the great enemy of your family. He said, if you want to protect your family, you keep control of your civil government, your politics. And that's what we're finding out right now. And that's what we saw in Loudoun County and Fairfax County and all these people saying, you're doing what in our schools? This is crazy. And so we've seen over the last two and a half years all over the nation, people are finding out what's going on and finding out that the state has become the enemy of the family and the crazy things that are going on. So what happens with that is this is where you have to get that local focus. And we're seeing this with school boards. There's a lot of examples I can point to. Let me just point to Virginia. Chad already mentioned 312 churches registered 77,000 people to vote, and 312 churches, Virginia's got tens of thousands of churches, 312 registered 77,000, vote biblically, Yonkin wins by 66,000. I think that's your margin of victory right there. Yeah, but it didn't stop there. Because you see, 1 Timothy says you can't be crowned unless you run according to the rules. Well, what are the rules? Most people don't know the rules of elections. But those 312 churches came up with 1,300 people to learn the rules. 300 state-certified election officials and 1,000 poll watchers. And you know what? Those guys, looking at polls to make sure the vote was right, found 5.2% fraudulent votes. There was one guy who registered to vote 27 times. Another lot, empty lot, had 17 voters voting out of an empty lot. That's not possible. 5.2% of the vote being fraudulent, that's the margin of victory too. And then they also said, you know what, out in the rural areas and out away from Northern Virginia, I mean, we got to outperform what we normally do. And so in the rural areas across Virginia, those 312 churches, instead of having a 35% turnout, which is common for a gubernatorial election in the country, they had 64% turnout. Yes. They overperformed. So I can point to 312 churches in Virginia and say, this is probably why you've got a new governor. Is because, now think what would happen if a bunch more got involved.
Right.
Then you start getting back the Senate, you start getting the House, you keep the House, and you start reversing policies that have not been God-friendly in the last several years. But you see, it's not only what's happening with churches in Virginia. There's things going across the United States as well. I was in Colorado last session. We worked with hundreds of churches there, and we took scores of school board seats just in one election. Didn't spend a dime, just got the church involved, let them know the differences between the candidates, had scorecards for the candidates, and we saw changes. Let me show you some of the headlines from last election, because most of us didn't see these headlines. This one says, candidates opposing critical race theory COVID-19 mandates win Minnesota school board races. Minnesota is, they're not liberal, they're progressive, and that's far left of liberal. And they're not even just progressive, they're just communist. I mean, they're crazy up there. Do you know Minnesota, by state law last year, said for the next 10 years in our schools in Minnesota, we will not teach students the American Revolution or the Civil War or World War I or World War II or the Holocaust. For the next 10 years, that is out of Minnesota education. And yet, we took the school board, Minnesota, yeah. And then I love this one from New Jersey. A 19-year-old who saw his senior year disrupted by COVID shutdowns unseats the incumbent in the school board race. This senior said, you goofed up my last year, and that's not good. I'm going to run against you for school board. In New Jersey, he won by 17 points. Now, I'll point out, it's really nice to finally have an adult on the school board in New Jersey. It's really a good deal.
That's good.
And then, here, slate of conservative candidates declared victory in hotly contested Denver? Really? Denver? Yeah, I told you, we flipped school boards all over Colorado. The same three or four conservative challengers win seats on Wichita School Board. Wichita and Kansas, second most liberal city. You've got Kansas City, and then you got Wichita. We've got the school board in Wichita, yeah. And Treasure Valley, which is Boise. Boise, by far the most liberal city in Idaho. We got that. And then conservatives win big in school board elections. Policy changes could follow. This one, school board races in major Colorado Springs area districts are sweeping wins. We took every single school board in Colorado Springs area, flipped every one. One election, took every seat, got them all. And then Houston, we won Houston school boards? Really? There's 2.3 million people in Houston. Yep. And we got the churches engaged in Houston, and it only took between 3,000 to 6,000 votes to win the school board races in a city of 2.3 million. This is where having a local focus can really make a big difference. It's a huge thing. So I'll close with this challenge from Charles Finney. Charles Finney, a great revivalist. He's part of the Second Great Awakening. It's estimated that just in 1 year, between the year 1857 to 1858, in that 1 year, he led 100,000 people to Christ in 1 year. This guy also said, you know, revivals are something we can have. He said there's a science to revival. And he wrote a book in 1835 on how a nation can have a revival. And it's interesting because we think nations need a revival and we got to pray for revival. And he points out, no, the Bible is full of if-then verses. You remember 2 Chronicles 7:14. If my people, which are called by my name, will do this, then I'll do this. So he said, you don't need to pray about God doing this. If you'll do this, he will do this. Now, prayer is part of it because 2 Chronicles 7:14 says, if my people, which are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and do all these other things, then I'm going to answer. So prayer is part of it, but you just don't sit around and pray for revival. There's a lot of things to do. And so he went through the Bible and found all these if-then verses where the if you do this, then God said he'll do this. He said, so if you want a revival, start doing the if stuff. And so lecture 15, as he's going through all these various verses, lecture 15, this is what he said. He said, the church must take right ground in regard to politics. He said, politics are part of a religion in a country as this, and Christians must do their duty to the country as part of their duty to God. That's because this is a stewardship nation. Serving God, we need to have an influence here where we live, all around us being salt and light. He said, God will bless or curse this nation according to the course that Christians take in politics. Now, let me explain this. Proverbs 14:34 says, righteousness exalts a nation, sins a reproach to any people. If you want God to bless a nation, you need righteous policies. If you want God to bless a state, you need righteous policies. I mean, we sing God bless America all the time, but my goodness, if we want God to bless America, give him something to work with. It's hard to bless America if you don't have righteous policies, because that's what he's going to bless. How do you get righteous policies? Proverbs 29:2 says, when the righteous rule, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. You don't expect bad people to make righteous decisions that God can bless. Virginia's a case in point. What's the chances that you get more blessings in the state now under the policies of Youngkin than under the policies of your previous governor? Is God going to bless the state for killing babies after they're born?
No.
Ain't no way. You get that reversed, you got a chance of God blessing the state. See, this is why it's part of being involved. You want God to bless something, you got to take a position he can bless. And so this is, lecture number 15 was called Hindrances to Revival. He said, if you don't want a revival to come, just stay uninvolved. Stay out of politics, and that's a hindrance to revival. It'll keep it from coming. So this is significant stuff, and I just challenge you to think about this in America, and particularly getting involved. The churches can turn this in a hurry if we will. And by the way, if this information history is new to you, I would send you to the table at the back. We have a book called The American Story, which covers a lot of this. God bless you guys. Thanks for letting me share.